Okay, hi everybody. What we're going to be doing today is, by the way, just as a point of information, I cannot teach and read chat at the same time. I'll try and leave some time for questions toward the end, but I can't multitask quite that much, so I hope you'll all forgive me. We're going to be starting by doing a close reading of the Psukim of Megillat Rut. And a lot of what I find fascinating about the Megillah is the extent to which it has connections to other parts of Tanakh, both in sort of larger ways and in more subtle ways. And that's what we're going to start exploring today. Okay?
I'm sorry, can you make that bigger?
I can try. Hold on. If I can make it bigger, I will probably. Hold on. Plus, yes, it's not too big. Hang on. Okay, that was bad. As you can see, I am not exactly a technical whiz.
That's
That's
not very good. No, what you had a minute ago was
good.
good. And also people can,
That's good.
I think
I'm
that's
sorry. My problem is that you guys cover it. Here we are. Is
there you
that
go.
better?
Yeah, I think
Okay.
that's good. Anybody can use a Tanakh also, at least for the
That's
open
fine.
part.
That's fine.
I considered, by the way, asking you to bring Tanachim, but I decided this way I can point and people can follow as I read. I'm going to read and translate, and we will start right away. Okay. And it was in the days of the judging of the judges. And there was a famine in the land. And a man from Beit Lechem Yehuda went. Lagul b'shdei Moav. The word lagul means to sojourn, to live temporarily in the fields of Moab, hu v'ishto u'shnei banav, he and his wife and his two sons. Now, this pasuk actually carries a great deal more weight than you might imagine because it is evocative of many important things. First of all, the period, the days of the Shvot HaShoftim, the judging of the judges, is a dark period in Jewish history. It's not seen as a time of it's not our shining hour. It is not the golden age of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. We'll see why. It's also the story starts with a famine. A famine is always bad news, right? And it's interesting if you remember from Sefer Shmot, Perek Bet, Vayelech ish mi Beit Lechem Yehuda lagur b'shdei Moav. Vayelech ish, a man went, right? And that is the opening to the story of the Moshe birth, right? Vayelech ish mi Beit Levi, vaykach et bat Levi. A man of the house of Levi went and took a woman of Levi, and Moshe is born from that story. Here, though, we have a sort of unraveling of that redemptive or the beginning of a redemptive moment. And there's a clue here. We'll look at some of the Midrashim in a minute. He's going from the house of bread in Yehuda to the fields of Moab. Now, Moab, Beit Lechem, even though literally we don't think about it as house of bread, but that's what it is a symbol of sustenance, a symbol of generosity, of security, of all of those things, to have a house of bread, right? To have a house where bread is present. The fields of Moab are associated with a very different attitude to bread, right? What are we told about the Moabim and Ammonim, the people of Moab and Ammon? That the reason they're not permitted to marry into the Jewish people is because al dvar asher lo kidmu etchem balechem uvamayim b'tzeitchem imitzrayim. They did not precede you. They did not come toward you with bread and water when you were leaving Egypt. So there's something very paradoxical and problematic here. We are told the name of the man only in the second pasuk, right? But we're in a dark period of Jewish history. We're going to see even there's another indication of darkness in this story. We're in a dark period of Jewish history. There's a famine. Someone is leaving the house of bread to go to the place where people don't give bread. Okay? If you take a look, I'm going to scroll down here to Megillah Yud Amud Bet. This is something I mentioned, those of you who are in my Megillat Esther class. Amar Rabbi Levi v'itema Rabbi Yonatan. Rabbi Levi said, and there are those who say it was Rabbi Yonatan, Davar ze masoret b'yadeinu me'anshei Knesset ha'gdola. This thing is a tradition in our hands from the men of the Great Assembly.
Kol makom shen ema vayihi, wherever it says vayihi, eno ela lishon tzav. It's a language of distress, of suffering. The word vayihi sounds like vay, oi, right? That's what it sounds like. Vayihi bimei Achashverosh, and it was in the days of Achashverosh. Hava Haman, there was Haman. Vayihi bimei Shvot HaShoftim, and it was in the days of the judging of the judges. Hava Ra'av, there was a famine. Now, if you'll notice, it is an ellipsis here. I left out just the part of the discussion in the Gemara. Amar Rav Ashi said, Kol vayihi ikahachi v'ikahachi. The discussion that we left out is a long discussion in the Gemara of places where it says vayihi, and it was, and it is not expressing tsar. It is not just expressing distress. So Rav Ashi says, every time it says vayihi, there are those like this and there are those like that. There are places where vayihi is a language expressive of suffering, and there are places where it is not a language expressive of suffering. However, vayihi bimei, when it says, and it was in the days of, eno ela lishon tzav, it's always a language expressive of suffering. And he brings his proofs. Chamisha vayihi bimei, there are only five places in Tanakh where it says vayihi bimei. Chazal know their Tanakh. Chamisha vayihi bimei havu, there were only five places. Vayihi bimei Achashverosh, vayihi bimei Shvot HaShoftim. In the days of Achashverosh, there's Haman. In the days of the judging of the judges, there's a famine. And then the others are, there's war, and there's other bad stuff that happens. Okay. Rud Rabba says something else here. Vayihi bimei Shvot HaShoftim, the judging of the judges. It was in the days of the judging of the judges. The phrase is ambiguous. It could mean either in the days that the judges judged or that the judges were judged. Even in English, if I say in the days of the judging of the judges, who's judging whom, right? Oy lador sheshaftu et shofteihem. Woe to the generation that judged their judges. Ve'oy lador sheshoftav tzrichin hishafet. And woe to the generation that its judges required judgment. Sheneemar, as it says in Sefer Shoftim, v'gam el shoftehem lo shamehu. Okay? And they did not listen even to their judges. In other words, if you read Sefer, and I'm not going to go through the rest of the piece from Rut Rabba here, but if you read Sefer Shoftim, it's a pretty miserable period of Jewish history. You think of some of the judges, you think of some of their excesses, their failures, their mistakes, their corruption. It's a judge that a generation that the people looked at their leaders and they were critical of them because they deserved to be criticized. The Gemara in Bava Batra says something similar. V'amar Rabbi Yochanan, my dichtiv ha'ibi meshvot ha'shoftim. Why does it say in the days of the judging of the judges? Dol sheshofet et shoftav. It was a generation that judged its judges. Omer lo tol kiseh miben enecha. A judge would say to somebody, take out that splinter from between your eyes. Omer lo, so the person whom the judge was rebuking would say, tol korah miben enecha. Take that beam of wood out of your eyes. Omer lo kaspecha haya lesigim. This is a quote from Yeshayahu. The judge would say, your money is impure. Remember, money was smelted from metal. The money was worth its weight of metal. Omer lo sav ech mahul b'mayim. The person would say to his judge, your wine is diluted with water. Excuse me, just one second. Sorry, some unexpected, very small company. So we don't have a lot of control over what's going on the other side of this door. Okay, anyway, the generation here, so we're reading this first pasuk, the Navi, the author of Sefer Rut, of Megillat Rut, like the who was also the author of Sefer Shoftim, is Shmuel Hanavi. He's not writing as a Navi. He's writing as a from Ruach HaKodesh, but he is packing in an awful lot of heavy weight in that first sentence, in that first discussion that we have here. If we take a look at just one more source, and then we'll go back to the Psukim. Oh, let's keep reading. I'm sorry. Let's go back to the Psukim. V'shem ha'ish Elimelech. And the name of the man was Elimelech. V'shem ishto Naomi. And the name of his wife was Naomi. V'shem shnei banav Machlon v'chilion. And the names of his two sons were Machlon and Chilion. Ephratim. Ephratim means either from Ephrat, which is another name for Beit Lechem, right? It's another name for Beit Lechem is Ephrat, which also has that sense of poriut, of fruitfulness, okay? Mi Beit Lechem Yehuda, from Beit Lechem Yehuda, or Ephratim can mean noblemen, people of high social standing. Vayavo ste Moab vayiyusham, and they came to the fields of Moab, and they were there. Okay, so all we know is the name of the man, the name of his wife, and the names Machlon and Chilion. Chazal darshan the names, the Chazal expound the names, and it's kind of interesting because these names have sort of negative connotations. Machlon could be like Machala, sickness, Chilion, destruction. There are other ways expound these words, but there's sort of that sort of names that are sort of double-edged swords. You'd be careful before you give a child a name like this. Okay. And then we're told they go to Beit Lechem, Vayamat Elimelech Ish Naomi, Vatisha'er Hi Ushnei Vaneha. And Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she remained, she and her two sons. Okay. Here Chazal say, why is he called Ish Naomi, the husband of Naomi? Because a man dies only for his wife, just as a wife dies only for her husband. The person who feels the death of a person most is the person's spouse. But let's take a look here at what the Midrash has to say about what's going on in this very, very brief narrative. Vayira ba'aretz, and there was a famine in the land. Lama ne'enash Elimelech? Why was Elimelech punished? Because it's clear that he's punished. His death is striking, and it's mentioned. And the Midrash answers, Al yidei shehipil liban shel Yisrael aleihem, because he cast the hearts of Israel upon them, meaning he took all the morale, all of the wind out of the sails of the Jewish people who were around him. He took the morale, he took their hearts away from them. Why? Elimelech haya migdolei hamdina umiparnasei hador. Elimelech was one of the great men of the province, meaning he was rich. Umiparnasei hador, and one of the leaders of the generation. By the way, lifarnes also means to provide for or sustain. And when the years of famine came, Amar, he said, Achshav kol Yisrael misavavin pitchi. Now all of Israel will circle the opening of my house. Ze bekupato veze bekupato, each one with his box, meaning they're going to come to ask me to take care of them. Amad uvarach lo mipnehem. He stood up and he fled from before them. Hadau dichtiv ve'elech ish mi Beit Lechem Yehuda. That is what is written, and a man went from Beit Lechem Yehuda. Now, what I find striking about this Midrash is it does not fault Elimelech for being stingy or unwilling to provide for the poor. He's a rich man. He can afford to provide for the poor. That's not what he's being faulted for. He's being faulted for lowering the morale, creating greater fear, greater feeling of vulnerability. If a person who is one meal away from starvation sees that the wealthy man picks up his, possessions and flees for Stei Moav, he's got to be saying to himself, I'm never going to make it. If he left, I'm going to die of starvation, right? That's the sin of Elimelech. He ran away not only from responsibility, but primarily he broke the spirit of the people around him. And for that, he deserves to die, right? He's a leader. He's a wealthy man. He leaves. And of course, now we understand more the significance of fleeing to Moab. If you think about it, there are very few people who will leave their home. And when they're asked by the, you become an immigrant, you immigrate to, to America from Ukraine, right? Nobody's going to say to you, why did you come here, right? But a man who is leaving behind helpless people wants to go to a place where he won't be criticized for being, for lacking generosity. Okay, so Naomi is left with her two sons, Vayis'ulahem Nashim Moabiyot, and they married for themselves Moabite women. Shem ha'achat Orpa, v'shem ha'shinit Rut. The name of the first was Orpa, and the name of the second was Rut. Vayeshvu sham ke'eser shanim. And they dwelled there for 10 years. And notice the progression, ladies and gentlemen. Elimelech goes lagul, to sojourn. He's not intending to stay, right? He's intending to sojourn, okay? The sons, Vayihiyusham, after their father's death, they were there. Here already, once they've married Moabite women, Vayishvusham, they dwell there, right? It's not, they're no longer seeing it as temporary. It's like the Israeli who says, you know, I'm going to drive a taxi in New York to make some money, but I'll be back. And, you know, after about 10 years, you know, he's got two kids or three kids. They speak English, they don't speak Hebrew, he's not coming back. That's what appears to have happened here. And the two of them also died, Machlon and Chilion. And the woman remained of her two sons and of her husband. And then we get two very, very interesting psukim. And I want you to pay attention to this. Vatakam hi v'chaloteha, and she got up, she and her daughters-in-law. Vatashav miste Moav, and she returned from the fields of Moav. Kishama biste Moav, because she had heard in the fields of Moav. Kipakad Hashem et amo latet lahem lachem, that God had remembered his people to give them bread. Vatetze min hamakom asher hayta shama, and she left the place where she had been, ushte chaloteha ima, and her two daughters-in-law with her, vatelachna baderech lashuv el Eretz Yehuda. And they went on the path, or they walked on the path, to return to the land of Yehuda. Now, a careful reading of these two psukim show that these psukim are very, very repetitive, right? You could imagine that we don't need pasuk zayin if we've read pasuk vav. Right? And vice versa. One of them would be sufficient. Okay? So what do we need the two psukim for? What are the two psukim saying here? And I think that if without looking at any of the midrashim or mefarshim, I think there's something interesting happening in these two psukim. In the first place, it says, now notice also the verbs are how they alternate between singular and plural. So she got up, and her daughters-in-law, and she returned from the fields of Moab because she heard in the fields of Moab that Hashem had remembered his people to give them bread. And she went out from the place where she had been and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they walked on the path to return to the land of Yehuda. Now, notice the actual walking is all three of them, but there's something going on in Naomi that is only Naomi. And that's what we have to look at here. Vatakam, and she got up, she and her daughters-in-law, doesn't mean she stood up. What does Vatakam mean? It's a change in state of mind, right? She's, you know, She's going to get up and she's going to go. Why? Why is she leaving? And she returned from Shde Moav. She hasn't put one foot on the path yet, right? She hasn't taken one single step, but she's out of there. She has already returned from Shde Moav. Why? Because she heard in the fields of Moab that God had remembered his people to give them bread. And here the question is, the Midrash asks the following question. I'm going to come back to the middle source here. And she got up, and her daughters-in-law had returned from the fields of Moab. Because she heard in the fields of Moab that God had remembered his people to bring them bread. Notice what the Midrash says. She heard from the peddlers who circled around the villages. And what did she hear? That God had remembered his people to give them bread. Now let's think a minute about what the peddlers actually said, right? Now there's commerce, there's contact between Moab and, it's very close, by the way, it's right over the Jordan, right? It's very, very close to Eretz Yehuda. There's contact between Moab and Eretz Yehuda all the time. Businessmen, peddlers, travelers, right? This, you know, it's very, very nearby. What did the peddlers actually say? Well, I'm guessing that the peddlers actually said, the famine's over. There's grain in Yehuda. What does Naomi hear, though? God had remembered his people to give them bread. In other words, Naomi's continuing in Moab with her sons. Well, her sons aren't going anywhere, so she's not going anywhere, right? You imagine that Israeli taxi driver whose mother moves to Israel because that's where her son is, moves to New York because that's where her son is. So she's there. She's not going anywhere. But after her sons have died, she hears from the peddlers that the famine is over. Her words in her head, her translation of that is, God's not angry at us anymore. God has forgiven the Jewish people. He has remembered his people to give them bread. Chesed has returned to Malchut Yehuda. Yehuda is no longer bereft of food. And so she is out of there. She gets up, not in the sense of standing up, making provisions for a journey, but rather she has already in her mind returned from the fields of Moab. Then we get the actual description of the journey in Pasuk Zayin. Vatetze min hamakom asher hayta shama. She left from the places that she had been there and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they walked on the path to return to Eretz Yehuda. I'm doing a very close reading here because I think there's something interesting in this process that we need to think about. So what happens here? Vatetze min hamakom asher hayta shama. She left the place where she had been. Well, the obvious question is, well, where else would she leave? She would obviously leave the place she had been in. And also, Vatetze, she left. She's the only person who left Shde Moav. I skipped a piece of the Midrash here. Rabbi Azariah b'shem Rabbi Yehuda b'Rabbi Simon, Rabbi Simon. Rabbi Azariah says in the name of Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Rabbi Simon. Gadol Shabair, when the great person of a city is there, hu ziva v'hu hoda v'hu hatara. He is its radiance. He is its glory. He is its pride. V'hi shivcha, and he is its praise. Panamisham, panaziva, panahoda, panahadara. When he turns away from there, its radiance, its glory, its praise, its pride, panashivcha, goes away as well. V'cheinat motze v'yakov avinu k'sheyatza mi'be'el shava. And similarly, you find with Yaakov Avinu when he left Be'er Sheva. Now, it's very interesting. If you go back to Parshat Vayetze, if you count the end of Parshat Toldot and the beginning of Parshat Vayetze, there must be four, maybe five psukim that talk about Yaakov left his father's house and went to Haran. Yaakov went from here, he went there. Yaakov, and it's all the same repetition of information. Part of what's happening here is, as in the story of Yaakov, where we are told when Yaakov leaves a place, that creates an impression, so too with Naomi, which explains, I think, something else, which is kind of interesting. Naomi decides she's going home. For her daughters-in-law, that's not home. So why are they going with her? She must have been a magnet. She must have been a remarkable woman, a beloved woman, a loving woman. She must have been a mother figure to these two young women who go with her. They really don't have anything in Yehuda, and nonetheless, they come with her. And even more, vatelachna baderech, and they walked on the path. Hutzra lahem haderech. The path was narrow for them. Shehalchu biyachef, because they walked barefoot. Naomi goes to stay Moab, a rich woman, presumably in a wagon or a carriage, being driven by horses or other beasts of burden. She goes to stay Moab, a wealthy woman. She comes back barefoot, walking. When it says the path was narrow for them, it means that if you're not wearing shoes, you have to stay on the path. You can't just, you know, spread out and walk on the sides of the path because you'll hurt your feet. They're going back with Naomi to Eretz Yehuda, even though she has nothing to offer them. Nothing. Okay. Let's go on, and we'll come back and look at two more midrashim here. Vatomer Naomi lishtei chaloteha, and Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, Lechna shovna isha levet ima, go and return each woman to the house of her mother. Ya'as Hashem imachem chesed kasher asitem im hametim imadi. May Hashem do with you kindness, as you did with the dead ones, meaning her sons, and with me. Yiten Hashem lachem, may God give you, umitzena menucha isha beit isha, and let each woman find peace in the house of her husband. Vatishak lahen, and she kissed them. Vatisena kolan vativkena. And they lifted their voices, and they wept. Okay, so what's going on over here? As they're walking back to Eretz Yehuda, Naomi turns to her daughters-in-law and she says, and this is the first time the word chesed actually is mentioned in the story. Chesed is an important motif in the story. We'll talk about why in a moment, over the course of our readings. Okay. Naomi is walking with her two daughters-in-law and she says, go home. And you can almost hear her say it. Mamala, sweethearts, my beloveds, go home. Go back to your mother's houses. I appreciate God should repay you for the kindness that you did with the dead ones and with me. Chazal explained that they did not demand, they paid for their own husband's burials. They did not demand anything from her or ask her for anything. And may Hashem send you husbands. That's what she's hoping for them. I hope you have a life. I hope life goes well for you. She kisses them and they begin to weep. The only person, by the way, in this perek who does not weep once is Naomi. She can't wait to get home. She's ready to shuck everything off and just leave. Okay. Vatomar nala, and they said to her, Ki itach nashuv l'amech. And they said to her, but we will return with you to your people. Vatomer Naomi. And Naomi said to them, Shovna mnotai, go back, my daughters. Lama telachna imi, why should you go with me? Ha'od li banim b'me'ai v'hayu lachem la'anashim? Do I still have sons in my insides that they...
Shovna bnotai lechna. Return, my daughters. Go back. Ki zakanti mihiyot leish. I'm too old to be with a man. Ki amalt yesh li tikva. Because I said, if I want, I think that if I had any hope, gam hayiti halayla leish, I would have relations tonight with a man. The gam yaladati banim, and I would have children. If I could, I would have more children. Halahen tisaberna. Adasher yigdalu, will you wait for them until they grow up? Halahen te'agena levilti heyot le'ish, for them will you be anchored to be without a husband? Al bnotai, don't my daughters. Kimar li ma'od mikem, because it is very bitter to me from you. Ki yatza biyad Hashem, because the hand of Hashem came out against me. Okay. Now, up till now, I think we've seen that Naomi is concerned for them. She cares about them. She thinks they're good girls. They were good to her. They were good to her sons. She wants only the best for them. She thinks that, you know, she hopes that God will repay them with marriages. Here she says something that is far more difficult to hear for anyone. She says, Mar li ma'od. Me ken. It is very bitter to me from you. You are the cause of my bitterness. Ki yatza biyad Hashem, because the hand of Hashem has come out against me. What is she, I don't want to say accusing them of, or what is she saying about their relationship to her? Well, I would suggest that what she's saying is, you're very good people, and this isn't your fault, but my sons died because of you. Go home. I don't want you to come with me. Up till now, it's go home for your own good. Here it is, go home because the hand of Hashem has come out against me and not against you. Vatisena kolan vatifkena od. And they lifted their voices and they wept again. Vatishak olpa lechamota, and olpa kissed her mother-in-law, v'rut davkaba, and Ruth cleaved to her. This is the turning point of the story. And here we really have to understand how Chazal understand the development in this story. Okay. Let's come back to Ruth for a moment. If you noticed, I titled the chapter Ruth v'Opa, because I think that's what it's really about, the difference between Ruth and Opa. And here I'd like to go back to some of the midrashim we skipped. Okay? Ruth Rabbah here, Vayis'u lahem nashim mo'aviyot. You know what? Maybe we'll take a 5-minute break for questions. No participants. Okay. Any questions? Should we go on?
Yes, I have a question.
Yes.
Hi, I'm sorry. Let me put my camera on. So in verse 9, Vatisaena, they lifted their voices. You could read that as all three of them cried. Nomi too. But then in verse, 11? Where Anna is written chaser without the olive, then I would say, okay, one of them is not crying.
No, okay, so let's read what the Midrash says. I don't think Naomi cries. I don't think Naomi cries. I think she's done her crying. I think Naomi cries when she loses her husband, when she loses her children, when she says to herself, could you mute yourself? I'm sorry, Ruth, can you mute yourself? When she says to herself, God is angry at me, that's when she cries. But I don't think she cries. Let's see what Chazal say about that missing Aleph. Okay, let me go back to the share screen. Unless there are other questions? Any other questions?
Yeah, just one thing. It says, Vatelachna, the Lashuv Le'eretz Yisrael, whatever it is. Yeah. So it says they are returning, but the daughters-in-law had never been in there in the first place.
No, Vatelachna is they are all walking, but Lashuv is only really Naomi. They're all walking, but Naomi is the only one who can be said to be going back. They've never been there.
I almost felt like the pasuk is implying that the three of them are returning, but really only one of them is returning.
I think it would be hard to write it another way. But let's keep reading, because I think there is. Okay, let's keep reading. Okay, and any other questions before I move on? Because I don't want to spend too much time. I want to make sure we get to the end of the parak.
Where would it fit in if it wasn't Sefer Shoftim? I realize it's separate, tells us about David HaMelech's heritage, but where would it fit in if it was left in Sefer Shoftim?
It's a machloket in Chazal. Was it in the time of Ivtzan? Was Boaz Ivtzan?
Right, I've heard that.
Is it? In other words, there's a machloket.
Not sure.
There are different opinions. I mean, everybody is sure, but everybody has a different opinion.
Okay, thank you.
How come the daughter-in-laws were not agents? They're just followers. They had suffered the same things that Naomi had suffered. They lost their husband. But they seem not to be agents at this part of the story.
I think they are agents. The natural thing for them to do would be to go home. That would be the natural thing for them to do. They're choosing not to, and that's impressive. The natural thing, with if you had a childless marriage, God forbid, if one had a childless marriage and had lost her spouse, one would expect her to go home where she'd have a support system. And the question is, why don't they? That's what I think would be the most natural thing. You know, I think even today, by the way, however attached one might be to one's husband's family and maybe maintain a connection, in a time when maintaining connection would have been very, very difficult, the wife is going to go on and see if she can have a life elsewhere. And that would entail going back to the people who could support her, take care of her. Nobody has nothing to give them. By the way, here, I didn't mention this, but I'm going to mention it. There is a misconception here about some kind of yibum situation here. And there is no yibum. There is no leveret marriage situation here. Right? Naomi doesn't have any other children for them to marry. She even says, you know, and even if it could have children, you know, what would you wait for them to grow up to have husbands? The natural thing for them to do would be to go home. And I think that would be the natural thing even today in a situation like this. Okay. Last question.
Excuse me. Yeah, were they Moabite royalty? That's what I heard, that they were daughters of...
Let's look at some of the Midrashim. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. So let's go back to the Midrashim. Where are we? Vayisulahem nashim moaviyot, and the sons married for themselves Moabite wives. Shem ha'achat Orpah, one of them was called Orpah. Shehafcha oref lechamota. She turned the back of her neck to her mother-in-law. V'shem hashenit Rut, and the second one was called Rut. Shera'ata b'divrei chamota. She saw into the words of her mother-in-law. Okay, now this is a pretty disturbing statement. Okay, Chazal take the names of Rut and Orpah. By the way, they do much worse things with the name of Orpah elsewhere. They have some very harsh, really borderline horrible things to say about Orpah. I'm not going to translate everything. It's a mixed group after all, and I'm faint of heart. But they say some really, really horrible things about Orpah. And the question that always bothered me, and the question that I have to ask here, and this is the question that I think lies at the heart of the first perek, the first chapter of Sefer, of Megillat Rut, is why are Chazal so hard on Orpah? Look, she wants to go with her mother-in-law. She gets ready. She follows her. She's walking barefoot, following her mother-in-law back to Eretz Yehuda. And yet she is treated as though she is some horror, some truly, you know, monstrous woman in certain ways. And we're going to have to examine that. I'd like to get to that. Rabbi Bevai b'shem Rabbi Ruven Amar, Rut ve'Orpah b'notav shel Eglon hayu. Rut and Orpah were the daughters of Eglon, the king of Moab, who was killed by Ehud ben Gera, which might again place this story for the reader. Sheneemar, as it says, Ehud ben Gera says the following to the king, Dvar seter li elecha hamelech. He says to the king, I have a secret to tell you, O king. Vayomer has, and he said, you know, be silent or, you know, be quiet. Uchtiv ve'ehud ba'elav, and it says, Ehud came near to him. Vayomer Ehud, dvar elokim li elecha. I have the word of the Lord to you, my king. Vayakam me'al hakiseh. And Eglon stands up because he thinks Ehud is about to tell him something like prophetic, words from God. And Eglon, the king of Moab, is showing respect to God by standing up. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Eglon, Ata amadeta mikisacha lichlodi, you stood up from your throne for my honor. Chayecha hareini ma'amid mimcha ben yoshev al kiseh Hashem. By your life, I will set up for you a son who will sit on the throne of God, meaning David. Okay, so we have, you know, this is sort of the beginning also of another sort of introductory point here. Chazal draw a connection between Ruth and, on the one hand, Ruth is a good girl. Orpah is a bad girl. She turned her back. Ruth walked with her mother-in-law, right? But both of them are the daughters of Eglon, Melech Moab, the king of Moab, who in the time of Ehud was taking a very great tribute tax and really oppressing the Jewish people economically, which was common practice in the period of the Shoftim. And when Ehud ben Gera comes to kill him and break the stranglehold of Moab upon Israel, he approaches the king saying, I want to tell you something from God. And the king stands up with respect. And Ehud takes advantage of that to kill him, which, by the way, he had it coming, so don't feel too bad. But the point is, God says, that respect for my name, that respect for God, is going to translate into you having a descendant who will sit on my throne. Now, we're going to come back to this, because there's something very important happening in the fact that Ruth is a Moabite, and it's going to be a sort of pivotal to our understanding of what the story is about. Okay, let's go on. And let's take a look at this, also from Ruth Rabbah. Batisena kolan batikena. And they lifted their voices and they wept. Chaser aleph. The word batisena should have an aleph in it, and it doesn't. It's missing an aleph. Tashash kochan. Their strength was weakened. Shehen mahalchot uvochot, because they were walking and weeping. Rabbi Brechia b'shem Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Brechia says in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak, 40 psiot halcha Orpah im chamota. Orpah took 40 steps with her mother-in-law. V'nitla livna 40 yom. And her son was granted 40 days, meaning his fate was not settled for 40 days. Sheneemar, as it says, Vaygash ha-plishti hashkem v'ha'alev. The plishti drew near morning and evening. Okay, what's the Midrash doing here? The Midrash is saying, that Orpah is the mother of Goliath. Okay, if you notice it, Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud Zayin, the story of David and Goliath is the story of Orpah's descendant and Ruth's descendant facing each other on a battlefield. Okay, so there's Ruth and Orpah, and from them come Goliath, and David. Okay, of course, who wins? David. Okay, but I think what's partly being alluded to here is, and we'll see this, I think, as we go a little bit further, there's a sort of split in the personality of Lot and his relationship to Abraham. Remember, Lot is the father of Ammon and Moab. Ruth and Orpah both come from Moab. David comes from Moab. Goliath comes from Moab. Even though he's called a Plishti, we'll see why. Okay. Now, what do the
Midrash says here, which is very disturbing and seems very unfair, is that Orpah is repaid for her kindness to Naomi by having a son who stands and blasphemes the name of God for 40 days, which doesn't seem, it seems kind of harsh, right? It seems kind of mean to say that. Okay, it isn't. Spoiler, it isn't. I'll explain why. Okay, but Rabbi Yudan b'shem Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Yudan says the name of Rabbi Yitzchak, Arba'a milin halcha Orpa im chamota. Orpa went 4 milin. A mil is it's not a mile, but it's a nice piece of distance. Va'amdu mimena arba'a giborim. And there were 4 warriors that came from her, 4 strong men who came from her. Shneemar, Arba'at Ela Yudu Lohorpa. These 4 were born to Horpa. Horpa is the other name of Orpa. Amar, okay, this is the part. Okay, I'll just do it. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak said, Kol oto halayla shepersha Orpa mechamota. That night that Orpa all that night that Orpa separated from her mother-in-law, nitarvu ba ervat goyim shel me'a bnei adam. They were mixed into her body, the erva, the nakedness of 100 men. Hadau dichtiv. Okay, we're not going to keep going. Rabbi Tanhuma says she even slept with a kelev, right? She even slept with a dog, okay? Because the plishti says to David, Hakelev anochi, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? Now, clearly this is an exaggeration, right? Clearly it's an exaggeration. Those of you who have studied with me before know that we don't take midrashim of this type literally because they are meant to be, they're fantastical, but they convey an idea and an important idea. And we have to figure out what the idea is. Here, we're much further into the nasty things said about Orpah. And this isn't the only source, right? Why is Orpah being vilified in this way? Why is Orpah vilified to the extent that she is by Chazal? Okay. We'll skip a few sources here. And we're going to come to, I think, an analogy that will help us understand what's going on here. I guess we're not going to finish all of the sources today. We'll continue Bezrat Hashem next week. I'm going to take you back to Bereshit Yud Bet, which is the story of Avraham. And God says to Avraham, Lech Lecha. And he says, and I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make you a great nation. There's a reason I am stepping away from Ruth to the Avraham story, and I'll make it clear in a minute, okay? Vayelech Avraham kasher diber elav Hashem. Avraham went as God spoke to him. Vayelech ito Lot, and Lot went with him. Va'Avraham ben chamesh shani v'shivim shana b'tzeto mi'charan, and Avraham was 75 years old when he left Charan. Vayikach Avraham et Sarai ishto ve'et Lot ben achiv, et kol chusham asher rachashu. And Avram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his nephew, and all of their possessions that they had acquired, ve'et ha'nefesh asher asu b'charan, and the souls that they made in Charan, ve'yitzu lalechet arza Kenan, and they went to go to the land of Kenan, ve'yavo arza Kenan, and they came to the land of Kenan. Now, I just want to point out, we're going to see many parallels between Ruth and Avraham. One that I think is very, very important is that the story of Ruth starts for Ruth with a journey. Okay, that's a really, really important parallel between the two of them. The text will make an explicit connection to Avraham, but there are clear parallels here. Okay, Avraham leaves, he's with his wife and his nephew. And his nephew is the son of his brother, who, according to the Midrash, dies because of Avraham's belief in God, breaking the idols, going to Nimrod. But either way, Avraham is very connected to Lot, and Lot is connected to Avraham. Okay, what happens, and we're going to skip the rest of Perek Yud Bet of chapter 12. We're in Perek Yud Gimel. What happens is Avraham goes in the face of famine also. His story starts with a famine, right? He starts in the face of famine, He goes to, please mute yourself if you're not muted, whoever you are. Okay. He goes to Egypt and he comes back from Egypt a very, very wealthy man. And it says, Vayal Avrami Mitzrayim, and Avram came up from Egypt, Hu v'ishto, he and his wife, v'chol asher lo, and all that was his, v'lo dimo, and lo with him, Hanegba, to the south of Eretz Yisrael. A student of mine, very clever young man, said, notice that Lot is divided from Avraham by possessions here, right? Avram comes up, he and his wife, and everything that was his, and Lot was with him, right? Lot's, Lot's on the side already. V'Avram kaved ma'od b'mikneh b'kesef u'v'zahav. Avram is very heavy with cattle and silver and gold. V'yelech l'masa'av minegev b'ad Beit-El, and he went according to his travels from the south of Eretz Yisrael to Beit-El. Ad ha'makom asher haya sham ohalo b'tchila b'in Beit-El u'v'in ha'ay. To the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Beit El and Ha'ai. And to the place of the altar, El Mekom HaMizbech, Asher Asasha Barishona, to the place of the altar that he had made at the beginning, Vayikra Sham Avram Hashem Hashem, and Avram called there in the name of Hashem. V'gam L'Lot HaOlech Et Avram Haya Tzon U'Bakar Be'Ohalim. And also Lot, who was going with Avram, there were sheep and cattle and tents. V'lo nasa otam ha'aretz lashevet yachta. And the land did not carry them to dwell together. Ki haya rechusham rav, because their possessions were numerous. V'lo yachlu lashevet yachta. And they could not dwell together. V'yiri ben ro'e mikne Avram uben ro'e mikne Lot. And there was a quarrel between the shepherds of Avram's cattle and the shepherds of Lot's cattle. And the Canaanites and the Perizi were then living in the land. What's the quarrel about? So let's skip here. This is Bereshit Rabbah. There was a quarrel between the shepherds of Avram and the shepherds of Lot. Rabbi Berechia b'shem Rabbi Huda ben Rabbi Simon amal, behemto shel Avraham Avinu haita yotza zivuma. Avraham Avinu's animals went out muzzled. They went out muzzled so that they wouldn't graze on land that did not belong to them. Uvehemto shel Lot lo haita yotza zivuma. And Lot's animals didn't go out muzzled. Hayu omrim lahem ro'e Avraham. Utar ha-gazel? So the shepherds of Avram would say, theft is permitted? Hayu amrim lahem ro'e Lot. And the shepherds of Lot would say to them, kach amar ha-kadosh baruch hu l'Avraham. Thus said God to Avraham, l'zaracha eten et ha-aretz hazot, I will give this land to your seed. V'Avraham pirda akara ve'eino molid. Avraham is a sterile mule and will not have children. Lemachahu met, in the future he will die. V'lot ben achiv yorsho, and Lot, the son of his brother, Lot, his nephew, will inherit from him. V'in nachlin mititon inu nachlin. We are eating from what belongs to us, we're eating. What's the argument here? Abraham being Abraham is very careful to make sure that his animals don't graze where they're not allowed to. In a place like Eretz Yisrael, actually everywhere, grazing land is expensive and it belongs to people. And grazing can damage land and you don't let your animals graze wherever they want. The shepherds of Abraham are like their master. They learn his midot, they learn his standards, they learn to do things the way he does, which is honestly. You muzzle the animals. The shepherds of Lot are Lot's Talmidim, they're Lot's students, and they learn to think like Lot. And Lot, or at least his students, perhaps he would not be so bald-faced about it, but his shepherds say, look, really the land belongs to us. Really the land belongs to us because Avram's going to die without children. Lot is going to inherit from him. We're really only eating what already belongs to us. Of course, the rest of the pasuk says, the Kanani and the Prizi were in the land, which means that the owners of the land right now are not Avraham or Lot. The owners of the land right now are the people who are dwelling on the land right now. Okay. So there's a quarrel. Let's go back to the Psukim. Vayomer Avraham el Lot, and Avraham says to Lot, Al na tihi meriva beni uvenecha uven ro'ai uven ro'echa. Let there not be a quarrel between you and me and between your shepherds and my shepherds. Ki anashim achim anachnu. Because we are brothers. Now, the word brother in Hebrew, ach, can mean one of three things. It can either mean a biological brother, can mean a kinsman, or it can mean like bro. Okay? Here, here the word means kinsman. Okay? But there is a yitur lashon, there is an extraneous word here, a pleonasm, a superfluous word. It should say ki achim anachnu, because we are brothers. Instead, it says ki anashim achim anachnu. We are men who are brothers. What does the Midrash say in Bereshit Rabbah? Ve'yomer Avraham el Lot, al na tihi meriva beini uvenecha. Avram said, let there not be a quarrel between you and me. Rabbi Azariah b'shem Rabbi Yehuda ben Rabbi Simon amar, k'shem sh'haya riv ben ro'e Avram uven ro'e Lot, kach haya riv ben Avram leLot. Just as there was a quarrel between the shepherds of Avram and the shepherds of Lot, so too there was a quarrel between Avram and Lot. Hadahu dichtir, v'yomer Avram el Lot, al natir meriva beini uvenecha. Let's not quarrel. We're not gonna agree here. V'chi achim hayu, and were they brothers? Ella Shaya klaster panav domelo, but rather the features of his face were similar to his. Okay, so let's picture this for a moment. Avram and Lot have the same face. It happens with uncles and nephews. It can happen. Avram and Lot look virtually identical. What's the Midrash saying here? Here we have the introduction of a concept that makes its appearance in several places in Tanakh, which is that the good is the enemy of the excellent. There are several pairs in Tanakh. It's a French proverb. I don't know how to say it in French, but it means something like this. If you're drinking a bottle of wine and you're enjoying your bottle of wine and it tastes good, you're happy. Till somebody brings another bottle of wine, which is vastly superior to the bottle of wine that you're drinking. And what do you suddenly realize? Hey, this bottle of wine is not as good as that bottle of wine. That's a really good bottle of wine. And this is an okay bottle of wine. Okay? You have a similar concept in operation here. Avraham and Lot look like the same thing. You know, he's wearing a shtreimel, he's wearing a shtreimel. He's wearing a kippas ruga, he's wearing a kippas. Pick your whatever. He's wearing a kippas ruga, he's wearing a kippas ruga. He's wearing a suit, he's wearing a suit. Right? Right? They look the same. But Avraham is Avraham and Lot is Lot. And you see it in their shepherds, in the standards that their shepherds have imbibed and the way that they behave. The shepherds of Avraham would never behave at the standard that the shepherds of Lot behave. There are a few pairs like that, right? There's Yehuda and Reuven, right? Yehuda, Reuven is the Bechor. He's the firstborn. But who's the real firstborn, even though he wasn't born first? Yehuda, he's the leader, right? We could come up with a few more examples, okay? But the thing that is relevant here is Rut is the real deal and Orpah is the pale imitation. Because let's think about what Rut does. And we'll read the rest of the parak next week, Bezra Hashem. Rut says to Naomi, you're not sending me back there. I don't care if you're upset. I don't care if you don't want me. I don't care if you're going to be embarrassed. I cannot go back to paganism. I can't go back there. I can't live that life. You opened a different way of being to me.
you showed me a different way to behave, a different system of belief. You showed me chesed. I'm not going back there. I don't care. You don't like it? Don't like it. I'm coming with you. You cannot send me away. What does Orpah say? And it seems very reasonable at the time. Look, you're embarrassed. It's going to upset you if I come. You don't want me? Okay, I'll go home. And inevitably, Orpah is going to produce Goliath. She's not going to have a David as a descendant. She won't. She can't. Because she's going back to a place where there is no God at any level, right? There is no God, right? She's not going to join some nice Protestant congregation in Moab, you know? Like, there's no, she's not going to convert to Islam. She's not, that's it. She's kissing God goodbye. She turns her back on that. She doesn't fight for what's right. Inevitably, she's going to produce a Goliath, because that's the best she can produce if she goes back and comes part of that society, marries a man who will produce a Goliath with her. And Goliath is a man who blasphemes against God. This is the divided soul of Lot. There's the Lot who follows Abraham, the Lot who is willing to sacrifice himself for his guests, the Lot who knows what the right thing to do is, right? And then there's the Lot who says, sorry, I can't. I can't live up to your standard. That's the piece we haven't read yet. That will continue with next week. I'll take any last questions, because I know that we have to stop. But that's all Orpah knew. No, that isn't all that Orpah knew. Orpah knew Nomi. Orpah knew Nomi. Okay, so given that Orpah must produce his own chance, does that reflect on the values of Lot's father? Yeah, Terach was an idol worshiper. Terach, Haran, yeah. Haran was an idol worshiper too, right? Haran's an opportunist. Okay, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, we have to stop, okay? I don't think this is misogyny, because the attitude it's not misogyny. It's not against women, right? It's not Orpah chooses to go back to something she knows isn't the right thing. Mm-hmm. Like anybody, male or female, she has to take responsibility for her own moral choices. Okay, ladies, we're going to stop. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. I teach women mostly. Sorry. We're going to stop here. I will stick around for another minute or two. If someone wants to ask a question, that's fine. But see you next week. That's Radha Shah.
Thank you.
Very welcome. Lauren, you wanted to ask me something?
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yes, I did. I still think that there's misogyny there. I mean, they go on to this perverted thing that, you know, she had sex with 100 men and a dog. I mean, there's something very misogynistic going on.
Why would they imply
such a terrible thing?
Because they don't think you're going to take it literally. Are you familiar with the Rambam on Midrash? Basically, the approach of all the Rishonim on Midrash. When you hear a fantastical, exaggerated thing, right? You hear a very fantastical, exaggerated Midrash like that, because it wouldn't have been physically possible, and she would have only been able to get pregnant from one man, and no, she didn't sleep with the dog, right? What the Midrash is doing is, by using hyperbole, it's exaggerating what she did to tell you what looks like a nice girl who can't live up to the standards of her sister-in-law choosing to go back to her mother's house really means She's choosing to have children who can only turn out badly. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, Ruth turned out well, and she came from the same kind of background.
Exactly, because she chose otherwise. That's exactly the point. Ruth chooses to say, I don't care if you don't want me. I don't care if you're not happy.
But I mean, like, we have no way of knowing that Ruth's sons, more than likely, I mean, they died young. Their names are like sickly and, you know, their names are awful.
Wait. Are you talking about Ruth or are you talking about Naomi?
I'm talking about Naomi's sons. Her sons did not turn out well. And for all we know, they were not God-fearing. And, you know,
Orpah
wouldn't have known any different. You know, there was Naomi, but
she lived with one
of the boys.
Lauren, why does she follow her mother-in-law? Why does she follow her mother-in-law?
Probably she had very fond feelings towards her.
Why?
They both did.
Why?
She was probably a good lady.
She was a very good woman.
Yeah.
She represented a way of life that was very beautiful. It was full of kindness, faith, trust in God, right? It's pretty clear Naomi is a God-fearing woman. She represented a way of life which was completely different from what Ruth and Orpah came from, right? They came from a different kind of society. Right. So she did know better and she chooses to follow her mother-in-law. Let's put it this way. I think what happens in the first chapter is we see two women who start out looking like they're the same thing. The verbs are in the plural. They wept, they walked, right? The two daughters-in-law, right? What's the difference between them?
Follows her mother-in-law, eventually becomes part of the Judean
people. Why does one of them go back and one of them follow?
Ruth is very interesting because she really is the epitome of chesed. She's also a tikkun for her background.
No, but why does Ruth, forget about Ruth as a tikkun. Why does Ruth go after her mother-in-law?
Because
but what does she say to her mother-in-law? Don't push me away. I don't care.
Right, and she's also saying that I'll become part of your people, which is really beautiful and really something.
And what does Orpah say, essentially?
Orpah goes, but I think Orpah is doing what most people would do.
Exactly. That's the uncomfortable part of this.
But it doesn't make it awful.
Yes, it does. It makes her... not good enough in a very bad way. Or let's put it this way. In choosing to go back to the pagan life she had lived, to a cruel society, she was not thinking about the future, and she was not thinking about the consequences of her actions. Let me put it this way. Part of what makes us uncomfortable when we learn this is that most of us would have done what Orpah did.
Absolutely.
So that's the point.
It's familiarity.
Excellent is the enemy of the merely good. It's not good enough. That's the point. You don't become the mother of kings by being a nice girl. You become the mother of kings by being a great woman, by making the hard choices, by doing not what's good enough, but what's really right.
Okay, I still think they're being extremely unfair to her.
Not really. What does she produce? She produces Goliath, the man.
According to Midrash. I mean, we really don't know that. It's Midrash.
No, the name Orpah and the name Horpah are very close names. And there are some psukim in Divrei HaYamim, I think they list. Actually, it's in Shmuel. It might also be. it's inevitable that she would produce what she produces. She's going to produce idol worshippers at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me see if I could put it this way.
Yeah.
Somebody says, okay, they were dragging my Jewish neighbors away, right? And I didn't help. That's what most people would have done. That's true. That's what most people would have done. Okay. Most people did do that. And there were a few heroic people who didn't do that. And they say, mm-hmm. what? Okay. Is that okay that that's what most people would have done? Or do you have to be heroic?
Maybe you have to be heroic. It's not okay. But, you know, we don't know what we would do in the same situation. We don't know until we're in it.
But isn't he telling us? Better think about what you would do in the same situation. Pay attention. You know, do you want to be the bottle of wine that's okay? Or do you want to be the bottle of wine that is really, really good?
So does that mean that every Christian should convert to Judaism? Because they're not. No. Because they're not following, you know, a chesed kind of life. They don't have to be one God and all that.
This is nothing to do with Christians or anything else. Let's put it this way. Orpah is at a crossroads. And Ruth is at a crossroads. And there's a very stark choice. You go home or you go into the unknown and try to live the life of a better person. It's what you do at the crossroads.
Okay. Thanks.
I don't think it's misogynistic at all. I think it's giving women the same moral responsibility men have.
Well, but they don't say anything really horrible about Machlon and Kilion. I mean, they could have said also some kind of made up story.
Well, we are told that they were destroyed and the Chazal darshan their names as names of destruction. They don't darsh them in a nice way.
Well, but they don't say that they had sex with 100 women and a dog.
Maybe because they didn't, and neither did Orpah.
But they didn't
I think you have to get more familiarity with the hyperbolic language of Midrash. I shouldn't have that. I should have just left it on the page. But okay.
Can you share your email address?
My email address?
Yeah.
Okay. You can send an email to Rabbi Kelman, and he'll forward it on to me.
Okay.
Okay. With pleasure. Okay, everybody, I have to go to sleep because it's very late here. And Laila Tov, see you next week, Bezrat Hashem.
Thank you.